Hello everyone, I'm Anne Brady. I'm just here to welcome Vanessa Tuckfield from the Australian Flexible Learning Framework, who's going to talk to us this morning about the importance of copyright. So I'll hand over to Vanessa, thank you.
Thank you, hi everyone. I just as a little bit of background, I work for the Canberra Institute of Technology in Canberra. What I do there is teach the teachers about copyright, but I also teach a number of music subjects, so I have film and media subjects, so I have a fair amount of background in actually teaching this to students as well. And I also work under the Benchmarking Research Project to help teachers and trainers nationally think about copyright within their roles here. So that's what I'm here today. Now, if you have any questions, feel free to ask them while we're going through, because I'll be going through a couple of little subject areas, so feel free to ask during the wherever that your question hits you. Anne's got a microphone, so if you want to quickly put your hand up, that's fine. What I want to start with is that one. Now, this is an adaptation from Shane Simpson's music business book, but I think both music and teaching are passions, and we take them on because we are passionate about what we're doing. But we still have to live and eat at the end of the day. So that's just a little statement that I like. So what we're aiming to get through is I just want to very briefly cover the basics of copyright, just to make sure we're all on the same page in that area. Then look at some secrets for teaching and training in the digital classroom. What makes it different from a physical classroom, or what makes it the same, and those sorts of things. Then we'll move on to some of the free and open licensing schemes that are available to us as teachers and trainers to use. It's Creative Commons and Free for Education. Look at some useful sites. Think about the obligations and limitations that we have when we're using learning resources, both physical and digital. And if we've got time, have a quick look at the Copyright Kitchen and where you can get further information. So let's just look at the bigger picture for a moment. Copyright's part of a bigger group of intellectual property. They're known collectively as intellectual property, and we have a whole range of them. Patents, which is your new inventions. Trademarks, which you're all familiar with, the McDonald's, the Qantas's, those sorts of things. Designs are industrial designs. So you can't invent chairs. They've been pretty well established, but you can design a particular style of chair and have that protected. It's usually for commercial use. Circuit layouts is computer chips. Plant breeders' rights. So if you're interested in plants and nurseries, that's an interesting one. And trade secrets, which is usually dealt with through contracts. That's your employment contracts and things like that. But I really do want to concentrate on copyright, because that's the biggest issue that we have. It gives people certain rights. The obvious one is to copy material. But there is also to publish it, which we all know is to make it available, to digitise it, to broadcast it, and to publicly perform the material. And it's in a whole range of topics that it's available. Now, I'll run through these. I might get some feedback from you in a second. The first group is original works, and these are written works. What sort of written works do we create in this industry? Training programs, content, curriculum. All of this is quite often in written works. There's artistic works. What's artistic works might be? Pictures, illustrations, photographs, fonts, graphic design, computer-aided design as well. All of them consist sculpture. Musical works is obviously music, and dramatic works is choreography and screenplays. So a wide range of material. In the second grouping, we have subject matter other than works. Computer programs, fairly easy. Compilations, now these are not your compilation CDs. These are actually databases of information that have been compiled together. So if you think of your Yellow Pages, your bus timetables, train timetables, all those sorts of things are considered compilations. This one's quite interesting at the moment. There was a recent court case that sort of put some of it in doubt, because originally under the Yellow Pages case, they decided it took a lot of work to pull all this information together and it was worth protecting. These days, with our software and the databases that are pulling information in, it's not always as hard as it used to be. So there's a little question mark. The USA doesn't actually protect that, but Australia does. Then we have films, which is obviously films, but it's also TV shows, music videos, all those range of things. And then sound recordings. It could be voice, it just doesn't have to be music on in either CDs, or it could be just digital recordings anyway. Does anyone want to take a guess what the difference between the two groupings are? Okay. The first group are pretty much standalone. You can write a book and it can have no illustrations, no music, no nothing attached. It's just the book, just the words in the book. So it can be protected individually. Whereas the second grouping, a film is rarely just a piece of film. It has voice or noise or sound or music or something behind it. It will have a range of music. It will have performances attached to it. It will have a screenplay or a book that it was based on, so it actually has a number of what we call layers or chain of titles to it. So whenever you're dealing with anything in the bottom four or the subject matter other than works, there's a broader issue to think about. It's not just the copyright on the film or the piece of audiovisual material. It might actually be the copyright on the screenplay or the book that it was based on, all the individual pieces of music that appear in that film, the performances in the film. So there's a whole range of copyrights that have to be considered when you deal with the ones in the bottom. Whereas with the book, you could just theoretically have the words to the book, and that's pretty much it. So in our industry, we're creating a whole lot of different things. We'll have subject guides, workbooks, websites, quite often software as well, images and artistic works in the bulk load. A whole range, just about in every field that you're teaching, you'll have a whole range of these things that are pulling that together. You'll also have databases of your clients, of your participants of courses and things like that. So an RTO or any sort of training organisation is creating copyright materials all the time and working with them. It's not just using, we're creating as well. So I just want to talk quickly through some copyright shorts, and please ask any questions. Right, the default position under the Copyright Act of 1968 is that the creator is the copyright owner. That is, the person who first puts the information together or puts it down in a material form. So you can have ideas, and if you don't do anything with those ideas, that's fine. The moment you write it down, copyright will protect it. The moment you take the photo that you were thinking of, copyright will protect it. So that's the creator. The works one major exception is employees. Works created by an employee in the usual course of their duties, the copyright is usually owned by the employer. So you have to be an employee, not a freelancer or an independent contractor. It must be part of your usual duties. So it's important that the theory is that the employer has made the economic investment in the work, i.e. they've paid you. We could talk all day about whether it was enough or not, but the theory is that they have paid you for that already. So they own the copyright in the material. So when you're dealing with conferences and that, you're pulling together freelancers from various roles and speakers, you actually have to be careful, make sure that the contracts and things that you have allow you to use the copyright material in the way that you need to use it. I can't ask the question, does anyone know how long copyright lasts for? Because I've actually got the answer on the slide right there. The standard rule is creator's life plus 70 years. So let's think about that for just a second. It's 2009. Let's pretend I'm 40 and I write a subject workbook for this year. I live until I'm 70, so that's a good 30 years away. Copyright lasts for my life plus 70 years. My workbook will be protected until 2109. Does anyone care about it in 2109? Highly unlikely. But copyright under the standard form that it currently takes will protect it for that long. So it will not be able to be changed. There'll be issues around using it. There's a whole lot of things that happen because in Australia, copyright protection is automatic. The moment I hit, well, not even the print button, the save button on my work, it is protected. Okay. Then we'll have moral rights. Now, this is a moral right. It's not a copyright. So the economic part of copyrights is the copyright protection. This is a protection for employees and everyone else who's worked where they've given the copyright to someone else for a variety of reasons. You always keep the moral rights to the work that you create. Gives you three rights. The right of attribution, so the right to be identified as the creator. Now, many years ago, before this law came into effect, I worked for the Commonwealth. I wrote three books for them. My name is not on any of them because I was paid to do that. That's fine. At the time, it seemed like all well and good. Everyone that I worked with knew that I wrote those books, so it wasn't a problem. What happens when I leave? It's on my resume that I wrote those books, but there's no evidence anywhere that I wrote those books because it's not in the books. Now, I said, that's fine when you're an employee and you're there and everyone knows you did it, but when you leave, I think the right of attribution gives you something. It gives you the entitlement now to have your name in those books somewhere so that at least you do have that right to be acknowledged for the work that you've done. It's a fantastic one. The right not to be falsely attributed. Now, we all know, like with workbooks and things, they go through generations and they're constantly changing. At some point, you're going to turn around and go, that's not what I wrote all those years ago. It's not mine anymore. It's gone through too many generations. You can have your name taken off the work. Or the example I like to give a lot of people in Canberra, being a high public service department, is when they write reports, if the outcomes are not quite what they intended, but they're what the government intended, they can get their name off it, so they're not associated with that work anymore. And the right of integrity, which is a right not to have the work subjected to derogatory treatment that is prejudicial to the author's honour or reputation. Now, that sounds a little bit... But let me give you a couple of examples that might pull this one home. The main one is, who's familiar with the art gallery in Canberra, the National Gallery? Right. Who knows that they're now extending it? I've been passing the building works every day for the past year or so. Now, they wanted to extend that about 10 years ago, and they put in all the paperwork and asked that it be extended. And the original architect said, no, that would be derogatory to my honour and reputation of the building that I originally designed. So the extensions did not go ahead. We got a new art gallery director about 4 years later. He decided he wanted more space. He put in all the plans for an extension. The architect came back again and said, no. There could have been other issues, but the mate, you know, he's using his moral rights, right of integrity, said, no, that's prejudicial to my honour and reputation. I don't want those extensions to go ahead. And they didn't. I think he died about 18 months, 2 years ago. Those extensions went ahead very quickly. So at the moment, we're not enforcing that moral rights past the death of the creator. Another much more at-home one is myself. I got extensions on my house this past year. It's taken about 18 months. But before the architect would even touch my house, he said, go to the original architect who built it 13-odd years ago and get an email or a letter or something from them saying that it's okay for him to do the extensions. So it took me about 6 months to find the original architect, get an email from him saying that it was okay before the current architect would touch the house. So it is having its effect. I blame myself. The current architect is one of my teachers and he did exactly what I taught him to do, unfortunately for me. But, you know, I have a beautiful extension now which I'm busy trying to finish off. But it comes down to that sort of practical level, that what can happen with that one. So I just want to reinforce the breaking down of copyright again. This is one I use with my film students. I get them to think about all the elements in a film, the music, the sounds, all the pieces of music they're going to use in their film when they're producing it, what sound recordings. It's not just that music is a couple layers as well. Music is the music, the lyrics, the performance of the song. So even when you talk about a piece of music, you're dealing with a minimum of three issues of copyright. 9 times out of 10, it's the same person, so it's irrelevant. But we all know Elvis Presley did not write many of his songs, so he's got layers. Someone else owns most of the written works that he did. Those sorts of things can happen. So they have to think about those elements. Then when the music is finally recorded, there's the sound recording layer, so they need to think about that. The footage, they usually take themselves, but they can get pieces from libraries and things think about the issues. Then the script and where they got it from. With my film students, most of it they've got written it themselves, but not always. Sometimes the teachers set, other teachers set tasks for their films of something entirely out of a book. And then they may be using artworks and things. So they need to draw all that together somehow to get the permissions necessary to create the finished work, whether that's a 5-minute piece of film or a TV ad or something. They've got to make sure that they've got all their permissions for that. Now, I mean, I'll get to the student use of copyright material in a minute, and there's a lot of exceptions that they can use to access the material, but I make them go through this process because in the real world, in professional filmmaking, they have to know this process. So I make them actually do it at this point. So a couple of copyright secrets. Most people seem to think that the digital world is a new frontier and it's completely different to our old physical or analog world. It actually isn't. A lot of the rules that apply for copyright purposes in the classroom also apply in the digital classroom. So the same things will apply there. For those in the public education system, if you have access to your statutory licences, then you can copy the same amounts into the digital classroom than you do in the physical classroom. And that's something I should point out here, is that if you're in a private RTO, you're under a different set of rules than a public RTO now. Public RTOs have access to things called statutory licences. Is anyone familiar with the statutory licences? Okay, so I've got a few nods of the heads. I'll cover them briefly, but it gives you access to copy certain things. It's still paid for. Don't think you're getting it for free. Somewhere someone is paying for them, but it gives you certain rights. Okay, but I'll just run through these slides quickly. You need to remember to use your rights. Last year in Australia, we got a new right under the Copyright Act, or the year before, 2006-7 now, called 200AB. And it's a right that allows us to copy, it's a vague area, but copy music and other bits and pieces that aren't covered by our other rights and licences to use for educational purposes. And it's a fairly simple sort of three-step process. You ask yourself three questions, and if the answer's yes in all three, you get to use the material. But we haven't been using it very much, mainly because people have been scared. But it's important that we start using that. Mostly in the TAFE sector, and it is for non-commercial, so again, I'm afraid private RTOs get eliminated at this point in time. But for educational purposes, it allows you to copy music, because not too many TAFEs have music licences. So it allows you to use music in education, whereas up until the 200AB came in, we couldn't. And it gives us, it's a vague one, film as well, where you couldn't use film, you can now. When I mean film, I don't mean broadcast material, I mean you go down to the DVD store and get a DVD, that level of film. You can actually use that now. Not the whole film, excerpts of it, so 5 or 10 minute snippets. And I know my media teachers do, they cut out about 5 minutes out of, you know, 5 or 6 films to point out a particular directing technique. So they can show a sequence of them. So they take them off the DVDs, put them onto a single DVD, or actually they use them digitally, and then just show them to their classes in snippet form like that. And 200AB allows them to do that. They still have to reference where they got it from, and they can't break any technological protection measures or TPMs on the DVD. So if the DVD has some sort of lock that prevents them from, you know, taking material off it, they can't use it. But if it doesn't, then they can use it. Training areas? Yes. As long as it has to be for an educational purpose, and it has to be a non-commercial activity. So not-for-profit organisations can use it as well, because there's no profit going on. Yeah. Yep.
If it was for an online course, could you take that snippet and put it online?
Yes, you can. So for an online course, yes, you can take those snippets. Can I just clarify, when I'm talking about a digital classroom, I do mean a classroom that is password protected, that only students and the teachers can access. All the copyright privileges that we have in education in the digital sense apply to a digital classroom. It must only be accessible by the teacher and the students or the teachers, who the teachers nominate. So if you create a wiki, a public wiki, you lose all our privileges and rights. So when if you're using the public, you know, the free wikis and things, it's important that you specify that it's a closed wiki, not an open wiki, because both the students and the teachers lose any rights they had under copyright if you put it public, because then you're going that next step and you're publishing it to the internet to everybody in the world, and we don't have the rights to do that.
You said private RTOs, but we're a not-for-profit association. So when you were just saying about the music, mm-hmm. we would still be entitled to use that or not?
Well, the 200AB would apply to you, yes, but the statutory licences don't.
No. Okay.
Yeah, so some of the privileges do, but not all of them, I'm afraid. Yeah. Okay. Yep. Sure. Sorry, the mic's coming. It's just that they're recording the session, so.
I was just wondering about online courses, and you're saying teachers and students. If mm-hmm. it's in the workplace, does that mean that the employers would be blocked, or if you gave them the password and they were allowed in, would that be okay?
That would be okay, yes. Or even in an enclosed intranet where only staff are accessing it, that's considered a closed environment as well. It's publishing to the internet, because we all know everyone in the world can access the internet, so that's where we don't have the rights to do. We never got that right under copyright. So, and it's a very fine line. Look, I've had teachers who are trying to do the best for their students, and I'll give you graphic design as the example, because they do a lot of web design material as well, so they want to use the web, and they get the students to do projects, which is fine in the closed environment, but then they go, oh, gee, this is fantastic. You should put it up on the internet. And, of course, unfortunately, the students lose all their fair dealing rights then, and they can't put it up on the internet. So until they go and get all the clearances, let me rephrase that, they have to go and get the clearances before they can put it on the internet, which is a different process, again, that the students need to learn. Okay, labelling. Labelling has become one of the most important elements that, as trainers and teachers, that we need to do. Both your own work, so for creators of material, and as we've already clearly established, we create a lot of material, having a label on it becomes so important. I know quite often it's just a simple single-page work document, but in the digital environment, as you're probably well aware, it could end up anywhere at the end of the day. Students can download them and save them and move them and off they go, and suddenly they appear in other places. So labelling, having a copyright notice, even if it's just the name of the organisation, because technically in an employment environment they're the copyright owners, becomes a key issue. Also labelling other people's material. So under the statutory licences, which is Part 5A and Part 5B of the Copyright Act, that's the general terminology for them. They give you rights to copy. Part 5B gives you the right to copy a whole range of text material so that you can get it out of textbooks, magazines, journals, off any internet site. You can get images off internet sites without any problems. But labelling it becomes such a key issue because we do pay for that material. And has anyone been through a Part 5B survey recently? Oh, little hands, yes. My institute did one 2 years ago. They're fairly stressful events. Every photocopier is checked. Every time you even step near a photocopier, you have to fill in forms for a whole 3 months. They're fairly administratively a very heavy thing to do. But that's so the people who you obviously think are worth copying, because you're copying it to hand out to students, get some money for it. Because overall the education system's paying about $71-72 million a year for this material. So it's not free. I think in the TAFE environment it's a don't quote me, but it's around the $14, $15 per head at the moment. We're hoping to negotiate it down so it gets a bit less, but the reality is that's per student per year, that's roughly what we're paying across Australia for TAFE students, so that we can copy and give them material, give us in either hand it out physically or hand it out online. So you obviously think that whoever you're copying is worth copying. Label it so we know where we got it from. It's going back to our high school days of citations, reference, bibliographies, that sort of material. Yep.
Can you just clarify exactly what we need to do to label our work? Is it just a C, or does it need to have our name and the date on
okay.
there?
Okay, for our own work, I recommend, obviously, this is called a short form copyright notice. Has the C in the circle, the name of, if you're an employee, it would be the name of your organisation, or if you're an individual, it would be your name, and then the year that you're releasing this material out to the public. So that's called a short form copyright notice. It's just giving the basics. I recommend that. If that's not suitable, you know, my teachers say, oh, I'm doing an image that's way too long to go across the bottom of the image. I'm like, well, just CCIT, because we can abbreviate my institute down to three letters, 09. It's tiny, but, you know, we don't know where that image is. So it's whatever is reasonable. If you're doing a big, large website, I'd consider doing what they call a long-form notice. And I don't have an example of one of them here today, but you can just search the internet and look at every website, and there's, you know, long-form notices. It's the whole thou shalt not copy. Yep, up the back. I'll get the thing. It's mainly, like I said, because you just don't know where this is going to end up at the end of the day.
When you're dealing with images, do the EXIF tags that you can attach to images constitute an appropriate copyright notice?
It could. It's whatever is reasonable. Sometimes, I personally prefer them if you can watermark them on in a corner or something, purely because then it's more visible and it's a reminder to whoever one's thinking of stealing, possibly stealing that image or using it, that that it is owned by somebody. Another reason for doing that is when Cal do these surveys, they tend to look at the image or look at the text and they don't go much deeper. So if it's not at the front, they won't go hunting for the copyright owner to give them their due. So it's important, I suppose I'm saying, Cal can be a little bit lazy when they're searching for the copyright owners, so the more that you can do to help them so that you get the benefits out of it, if it's your copyright. Now, don't forget, if someone uses my material from CIT in New South Wales TAFE and we haven't got a written contract between us, at some point when they're surveyed, I will get a CIT, or actually I will get a check in the mail from the Copyright Agency Limited, because they will have identified our stuff. And we actually do earn a reasonable sum. You know, one year it's $500, but another, you know, it's been as high as $80,000, $90,000. So, you know, it's a bit like that. But that's because they could clearly identify that those works that were copied in whichever state were clearly ours. So if you don't, I suppose that's the other side of the coin. If you don't label your work clearly and it does end up somewhere else, you know, you have a great student and they download and do their work, you know, they're A-level students, and then they get a job in another TAFE somewhere else and maybe even in another state, they'll probably pull out your great material and continue to use it. So, you know, you'll get money for it at some point that way. That's another question.
With this labelling, do you have to put the version on it? Like a lot of local government stuff wants you to put version 1 or version 2. They want to know exactly. Is that to do with copyright?
No, or? It's not for copyright purposes, okay. That. So that's entirely up to you. That's a version in control, but copyright doesn't care. They're only interested in the year so that, you know, they can work out roughly 70 years from publishing date, because if they can't find the copyright owner, so they'll quite often work on 70 years from when it was published. So the year becomes relatively important. Yep, another question there.
We've done a toolbox this year in timber industry, and we took all of the photos. There's maybe 100-odd photos. And the copyright, of course, is Commonwealth. In fact, it's flexible learning.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding the photos, should we put a separate attribution?
I think how easily can they be cut out of the box and being used separately? That's the consideration. Whatever can be cut out and used separately, you might need to consider a separate notice on them. If they can't be, then there's probably not an issue. I mean, you also have to think of practicalities too.
The issue for me is that a lot of the guys, there's lots of people in them, and we know these people, they're our students. Mm-hmm. It's the their presence in the toolbox is fine and the guys have agreed to it, but if those photos started being used elsewhere, then the people in them may be less pleased. So I wonder if it's worth it's in some way controlling their use.
It's worth a consideration. I mean, you've obviously got the clearances from those students for the toolbox. I suppose from a management perspective, it may be worth tagging them so that if they do end up somewhere else, you've got a very easy, clear line to take action against whoever is using them inappropriately. The moral rights will still apply, so you as the toolbox owner and the Commonwealth could still take action if anything inappropriate happened with those photos. As long as you found out about it, I suppose that's the biggest problem, finding out about it. But, you know, there's still other actions of recourse. But it just having them tagged or, you know, the copyright notice on them just makes it easier. That's all. It just makes it easier because you don't want things to end up in court with a he said, she said argument. It just helps the line of those sorts of, if it does. Because this is one thing I tell my students quite often is, copyright's fine when it's working fine. You won't think about it. That's the good news. You don't have to worry about it. But when it goes bad, it usually goes horribly, horribly bad in a legal sense. And that's when, I wish I'd taken that extra 5 minutes up front, because now it would have been a much easier job down this end in the court. So it's a risk game too. You have to think about what risks you're willing to take in dealing with this material. Okay, so labelling other people's work becomes so important. Even the Copyright Advisory Group, or the CAGs, which actually act on our behalf, each state has a representative, they are now advocating that if you're using it, if you're a part of the TAFE system and using it under the Part 5B, they'd actually like you to put, I've got it in fine print, copied under Part 5B. Because now we're trying to really ensure that CAL, or the Copyright Agency Limit, do their job properly. Because for many years there was no redress when they didn't do things properly and things got a little bit out of hand, but we're aiming to really make sure that they only take funds for the material that we've used under Part 5B. Because at the moment, if you don't tag it, they'll take the money. And then they'll spend the next 4 years trying to find the copyright owner. They don't find the copyright owner and then take the money. They do it the other way around. So, and if they don't find the copyright owner, they put it into a fund and issue it to other copyright owners after 4 years. So it's important that we're tagging things easily so that they don't have to think about it. They can either find the copyright owner, you've got your name on the work, so it's easy to locate the copyright owner, or if it's used, there's the citation, reference, bibliography, whatever you want to call it, there so that they don't have to go find the copyright owner. Because if you've copied it from somewhere, you know, one, you know where you copied it from, and two, you obviously think it was important enough to copy in the classes, so, you know, let that person get their due reward eventually.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. Well, I know the sites, yeah.
And I often want to use images off there. I often want to use images off there, but when it says it's subject, maybe subject to copyright, and I try and email these people, it just goes nowhere. It just goes into a black hole. So I don't really, so I just go.
Look, and you know, it's one of the things with the internet, with the added freedoms it's brought us, it has brought us added responsibilities. And not everyone has been educated in copyright yet, so they're unaware that they are supposed to manage it.
So it is a problem. I'm not going to deny that. But we can work on find alternatives of people who are easy to use, or find Creative Commons material or free for education material where you know what your rights are. You don't have to hunt down the copyright owner. It might not be the perfect image that you wanted, but I'm sure these days with Flickr, with billions of photos, you'll find a reasonable equivalent. There was a question up the back there. But images are a problem. Everyone, I'm not going to deny that there's a lot of images on the internet you can use.
Just regarding the CAL license, mm-hmm. You mentioned that the copyright owner gets paid when the institute's been surveyed, and is there a procedure for notifying the CAL license people that you're using so it's not reliant on a survey?
No, not really. At the moment, it is reliant on the surveys, and you know, hopefully eventually that person will get picked up in a survey. That's currently the only way to do it, because they're so burdensome, really, administratively. That's the only way of dealing with it. Now, we are investigating digital ways of doing the survey so that a teacher never has to do it, but it is reliant on not learning management systems but digital object repositories, so management of digital objects. And most of the states aren't in a position to really be managing wholeness every digital object that their teachers are using in the state yet. So we're not really quite there. A few more years and we may very well be, which mean those people could literally get paid on a more often basis because the surveying will be much easier. We're not quite there yet. Okay. Move on to teachers' responsibilities.
When we are doing developing resources, one of the things that we encourage teachers to do is to develop their, you know, develop their own resources mm-hmm. as well. And this is this whole thing about user-generated mm-hmm. resources. Now, we don't want to actually provide teachers with a whole lot of this copyright policy background. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the simple business rules that while we are actually encouraging teachers to generate user-generated content, mm-hmm. but you know, these are the do's and don'ts that you have to bear in mind when you do your own resources.
Okay, well, one of the first things is label. If you create it yourself, label it somehow. If you've copied it from somewhere else, label where you copied it from. It's one of the basic elements that will save either the institutes a lot of money, because ultimately, don't forget, that $71 million comes out of our, not just TAFE's budget, it also comes out of schools' budgets, but I mean it's coming out of resources that we could be using. So labelling is very important. And then also I think one of the other issues is think about the free resources, which I'll come to in a minute. And then I want to talk about these things. I think these are fairly key issues as well, being role models. So that labelling, I mean, everyone should be labelling. And, I mean, students, we tell them when they hand in essays and things, they have to put in their bibliographies and they're not allowed to plagiarise. And so we're telling them not to, you know, to follow the right rules. And then we don't always do it ourselves. So it's when we find a nice little image off Google that we want to use. So making sure that we act as role models and do the labelling ourselves. And quite often I work with the teachers in my area to talk about not only just doing it, but why they're doing it. Many of my students fall off their chairs when I tell them $71 million goes just in these licensing issues. They just never even comprehended that it would be that much. Well, you know, and my filmmakers are saying if it's a good film, you know, your teacher will use it and it'll, you know, you'll get paid for it. So it's important that you, so bringing it back to them is always a very useful tool. Almost every industry uses some type of copyright or intellectual property now. So, and the user-generated material as well. So it's pretty easy to get them appreciating the issues of copyright from it very early on. Being explicit, and it's not a secret business. I have a lot of people going, oh, well, they learnt it in high school, they did their plagiarism stuff. Not all of our students went to Australian high schools, and not all Australian high schools teach these copyright issues and things these days. The Australian Communications and Media Authority have released a training package that are taught in Year 3 and Year 9, and it covers about an inch of copyright. So there's not a lot of copyright training happening in the education system yet. So it helps us if everyone's aware of it. For the people in the TAFE system to be aware of the statutory licences, I've covered Part 5B quite well. The other one is the Screen Rights Licence, which is Part 5A. It's actually quite a nice little licence. It allows you to take anything that's been broadcast on any television station, pay or free to air, or radio, so radio broadcasts as well, record it and use it in education. Not just play it in the classroom, but put it up in your digital classrooms and play that through. It's wonderful. You can use it however you like. So that's the Screen Rights Licence. It is broadcast. You can take podcasts off ABC sites as well. So it's a nice licence that we have at the moment. Oh. Yep. I'll just take that question first.
Sorry, I've just got...
Yeah, I think
so. Okay. My question sort of hinges off that. If you have a package that you send out to students rather than, our students at distance, if you have a package that you send out and part of that package covers a copyright, but it's not written onto every page, is that necessarily a problem if you have covered it in one area?
I don't think it's a problem. Like I said, you've got to look at what's reasonable, and that sounds like a reasonable way. I mean, the only issue for you then is to consider how much of it can they download separately and send off elsewhere that then loses that copyright message because it was in that part of the CD or DVD. Cal actually requires us, so the text-based copying actually requires us to have a pop-up. Not too many of us. I don't think my institute even has a pop-up when it comes to text-based material. So we had a question over here.
I just want to know how much approximately these licences cost.
I'm trying to think TAFE alone. I think the Part 5B is about $10 million Australia-wide. And the Screen Rights is only about 4 or 5. It's relatively small. But overall in education, the Part 5B on its own is over $71 million in Australia for educational purposes. That doesn't include the government licences. So, you forget that how much they actually cost because we're so quite often divorced from the actual payments. Like, Canberra's fairly, unique in the respect that we're one institute, so I do see the bills going through. But none of my teachers do. They don't know how much that all this is costing them out of the resources, so things to think about in that respect. Introducing the concepts of ownership and pride in work. Now, being a multicultural country, not all people are inducted into ownership of their objects that they create in the same way that many of us are. Sometimes you actually have to introduce the concepts of ownership because copyright is creator-based. As I said, the default position is the creator, is the owner. They are responsible for managing their copyright. If they do not, well, then people will copy it and it will get used. If they do manage it, then, they may derive an income from it. So it becomes very creator-centric work. So in some instances, in some cultures, you actually have to create that sense of ownership of that material first, just for the legal perspective. And also explain students their rights. One of my busiest times of the year every year is first semester. I go around to most of the first semester classes because the teachers like me to come in because I'm like that policeman. Sometimes I feel like I need a policeman's hat. But I go in, I explain what they're allowed to do as students. I explain all their fair dealing rights, which they have a similar right. They can copy up to 10% of a piece of material or whatever's fair. They can copy bits of film as long as they reference it all and as long as they provide that to the teachers. They can copy almost anything they like. If they need 5 minutes of a film or 10 minutes of a film, they can do that as well. So this is all under the fair dealing right of research and study. When you are doing personal research and study, you use that right as well. It's when you hand material out to the students, you're accessing our professional obligations under the Copyright Act, which is the licences and the Part 200AB and a few other bits and pieces. So, but when you personal research and so students get some great rights, but there are limits. They can't publish it, so they can't put it up on the internet. They can't put it in galleries, you know, if they've copied other people's work in their tasks. Any questions on that one? Okay. So students, they get to use the material. Like I said, they get to it. They have to acknowledge, so give credit as due. They work under the fair dealing. They need to work within copyright. Now, we also got some more rights in 2006 or 2005 regarding the ability for personal copying. Now, we all know we're allowed to copy, record our video TV shows now on video or DVD or PVRs. We can do that at home, no problems. We're now allowed legally to copy our digital, our CDs onto our MP3 players. Does anyone know the story behind how that we got actually got the rights to do that? And one of the, well, partially, but one of the ministers about 3 years ago got an MP3 player for Christmas from his son. Or was it daughter? I can't remember. But, and then someone said, oh, well, you can copy all your CDs and put it on. You'll have all your music there. And he went, cool. And then someone else piped up and said, well, actually, no, you can't legally do it in Australia. It's legal in the US, but you can't do it here. They went, what do you mean you can't do it? Nor can you record TV, even though we've had video recorders for the last 20 years. It's not officially legal. Oh, oops. Oops-a-daisy. So I think within about 6 months, we got personal recording. So we can now do all these recordings that we've been doing for years anyway. We can now record TV. We can, put it across onto MP4 players for those that like their iPhones with the movies on it. You can do all that now quite legally. It's not a problem. So that's great. But there's this sort of line that I suppose I'll have to call the intent line. If it's for personal use, it's not a problem. Then you move across to the educational. Yes, you can still do it in education, but there's actually quantity limits now. The 10% rule starts to apply. The fair, the whatever is fair but not the whole thing rules apply. So there's actually limits. Then you move into the professional and none of those rules apply. You either get permission or you use some of the free license material, but basically, if you want to use that film that you were watching on your iPhone, you now have to get permission to use it. If you want to play the music in the doctor's reception area, you now have to get permission. Well, you're always supposed to, but it's that line. You can play that CD at home, but you can't play it in the doctor's reception area. So it's an intent rule or an intent line. So crossing it suddenly changes what you can do with the material. So for many of our students, while they're students, they can do all sorts of things. Then they move into their professional lives and it's different rules apply. So teaching them to understand where those different rules are. My graphic design students have a lot of problems with this because they do a lot of work in the classroom designing websites and things like that. Suddenly when I say you can't put it up on the internet until you get the clearances because they've copied someone's work in it, they suddenly, you know, it's a whole different story for them. So students need to understand within each industry where the rules are. Even hairdressers need to understand that they need licenses to play music. Beauty therapists need to know they need the license to play that lovely, relaxing music. Mechanics, same with it, mainly the music then when you start into those areas. But almost every industry that uses any sort of copyright material professionally need the licenses. So I do talk to my students about the screen rights, the CAL licences and the fact that they can't just walk out of our classroom and do whatever they like with the material I'm giving them. I have a question up the back.
Selfishly, because I represent an enterprise RTO, I need to ask the question about this commercial application.
Mm-hmm.
If we were to use material for the in-house education of our own employees, is that technically not for profit? Are we allowed to use that material?
Well, you're educating your own employees, so that would be a different application because it's not a commercial activity then. The moment you actually have the paid students come in, that's a different story. But, yeah, you could train your own employees. Okay, another question halfway down the front.
have a couple of questions. One is, I do run a beauty college.
Mm-hmm.
I do put the music CDs on, which you're telling me under an educational training I'm allowed to.
Yes.
But then I'm actually teaching my students to go do that, aren't I?
And if you haven't made it clear with them that when they go out into their own salons that they actually need an APRA licence to continue doing it, or to do it out in their own profession, yes.
Okay, so I'll stick to the radio?
No, the radio, you need a licence for radio as well, because you're using it in a professional environment. It's a public environment because you have people coming in and out of it.
So they can't even turn the radio on in there?
Not if the public can hear it. And there's been lots of cases where, that's why I said mechanics, because quite often the mechanics have the radio going up the back, and technically that's fine, but if the reception area can hear it, so if they have it too loud, it then becomes a professional activity and you need a license. Look, in all honesty, APRA's pretty good about this. I shouldn't gossip, but they are fairly good about it. And if it's a very small business, they may give a license for free. They're pretty cool about it. But look, the sports trainers. Now, who goes to here has ever been to a gym and not heard music of some form? Okay, sports trainers. APRA took them to court about 2 years ago because they were saying they weren't using music in their industry. It was not part of the, you know, they could go without it sort of thing. Why should they have to pay for it? And they lost. So for the $50 license, it would have cost them for an annual fee. They spent that hundreds of thousands of dollars in court, as far as I know. Up the back, there's a question.
So in the gym we have it where we work. If the radio's on, that's okay?
No, radio, if it's in a, if it, is it a public gym? Can members of the public enter
that? It is
that?
Now open to raise money in the TAFE. They've opened it to the general public at certain
yes,
hours.
Yes, it should. Yeah. Look, my gym that we use to teach our training sports trainer students have licences because we have members of the public coming in and out of that environment. So even in the TAFE environment, because we don't get a blanket music licence, the TAFE hasn't collectively negotiated a blanket TAFE music licence, I have to get a licence for the restaurants, I have to get a licence for the gym, I have to get a licence for the salons, because we do allow members of the public to come into those environments for cheap haircuts, cheap, you know, sports training, whatever. We get licences for every one of those spaces.
I can see the CD, yeah, I can see that definitely, but the radios are already paying for the rights to play that music. So I don't get where, like, you know, like, you sit in a car that's personal, you know what I mean, but the radio, it's this degree of paying, do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Someone's already paying for that, right? At our TAFE, I'm sure everyone believes, I'm going to take this information back, but I'm sure everyone believes that, we don't play CDs, we don't play anything like that, because we're aware of that, but they're going to be shocked when I go back, because they're under this apprehension of this thing that someone's already paid for the right to play that music.
Yeah, it's not so much about where in the chain it's being paid for currently. It's more about the fact that you're using it in a professional. You're creating an environment that is conducive for people to spend money, I suppose, in a loose sense. So it's a public space, so that's the issue. Not, you're doing a public performance of that radio. Yeah. That's what the actual issue is, not about where in the chain it was actually paid for.
Just go back to one thing you said before. With that CD that I have, if I put it onto my MP3 player, it's all right.
Yep.
But I can't make another CD of it, can I? The MP3 players?
No, actually you can, as long as it's for personal use. So they actually say that some of the examples that they've used in the explanatory memorandum is if you wanted to create a copy of your CD just to play in your car, so it's still personal use, that's fine.
But you can't do that with videos, can you? DVDs?
No. No, that's the dividing line. You can put it on your MP4 or your iPhone or whatever. Okay, so lots of issues for students as well. It doesn't go away, it actually. Creative Commons, 5 minutes. Okay, I'm just going to fly through the free stuff for you. These are places you can all go, and the end of the slides has actually got a reference thing as well, so you can go and look at these out. Creative Commons is a wonderful way for teachers to use material. Now, you'll be very pleased to hear Creative Commons actually based their licences upon the AE ShareNet system that we had here in Australia, or still do. So they actually copied us, but Creative Commons has gone bigger, huger, better around the world. If you want music for your photo stories, look up some Creative Commons music sites and you'll find a whole range of music. If you want photos, Flickr, you can specifically do searches for Creative Commons images, so you can find a whole stack of images. It's just, and we don't pay for it. As long as you tag it, Creative Commons, no one's going to have to pay for it. So they have a range of licenses, attribution being the most basic, share alike, so a range of them, but I don't have time to go into depth. But if you go there, they'll explain it all for you. And there's great stacks of teacher resources as well, so how to do exercises with your students using Creative Commons material. So they're very good. The AU ShareNet licences are still around, and I still like to use the Free for Education one, so that means you can use 100% instead of 10%. Don't forget, Part 5B is only ever 10%, whereas the Free for Education Creative Commons, you can use 100% of the material. They've got a whole range of licences, including the commercial ones as well, and that's going into Lawn. Lawn uses that system. The Copyright Kitchen is one of the key areas to find information. It's more of a question and answer database, but it's really important that you know that it is updated on a regular basis. I'm still doing the updating to it, so it's there, it's live, and it's changing all the time. If you don't find your question in there, it is so important that you send the email and ask it, because one, you get a personal answer from me, so I will respond and give you a direct answer, but then I will put a generic version up in the kitchen so someone else gets to benefit from it. So it's there and it's alive and it's being used. Okay. So there's a whole range of smarts. The smart copying site, I think these are going up on eLearn anyway, so there's a question, it's just there. So yeah, you'll be able to access this online. Smart Copying is the Copyright Agency, Copyright Advisory Group's website, and they've got a whole range of just worksheets for information.
Sorry, all of this information that you've given today is basically for TAFEs, not for private RTOs, is that correct?
Well, when I've talked about the licences and that, that's for TAFEs, I'm afraid, yes.
But the other general principles apply,
all still apply across.
So what about the 10% education?
Students get the 10%.
Sorry, yes, but yeah. If we wanted, you know how the TAFE can also use...
That's the stat licence, which is not available.
So in other words, a private RTO can't use anything.
Can go to the Copyright Agency Limit and get a blanket licence, which is roughly the same price relative to student numbers, and it allows you to behave like a TAFE, if you like. You get to access similar material as you would as a TAFE.
Okay.
So there is always options, always can get permissions.
Okay, thank you.
So smart copying is definitely TAFE and school-based, but it has some resources. Creative Commons, again, Australian Digital Alliance is just they're a group that got together that got sick of copyright always going in the way of creators, and that's a whole nother session and story, but they've created resources for you as well. Libraries, obviously, because they've been responsible for copyright for a long time, have a fair amount of information. Copyright Council I like, because they've got a whole stack of information sheets like... copyright for architects. So whenever I'm going to present to architects, I go and get that information sheet just to help myself remember all about architects. So they have them, you know, for fashion and so for different industries. And the Copyright News, if you want a particular story about a particular topic, there's stuff going on. People forget that copyright's happening every single day. I'm probably 3 days behind in my stories already because I've been out of the office for a couple of days. There's going to be a whack of news stories for me when I get back, whether it's a story about someone being sued for copyright on recipes. It happens regularly somewhere in the world. Fashion, they're always getting copyright, so all over the place. Music, obviously, on a daily basis. So I think that's about it, unless there's any last quick questions. We're getting a lineup behind us, so I need to get off. But I'm around for the 2 days, so feel free to harass me, and I've got business cards. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Fantastic.